content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the 2017 Leaders in Diversity. As the Triangle grows, so does its workforce diversity. These executives are leading the charge. That's the headline. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a series of headlines. It's a special section, and we'll start with the from the sponsors, celebrating the achievements of Triangle Leaders in Diversity. Congratulations and thank you to the winners of the 2017 Triangle Business Journal Leaders in Diversity Awards. The winners, as well as the businesses and individuals nominated, are what make our region such a strong economic and cultural powerhouse. The Triangle continues to attract top talent, growing companies and emerging industries because of our collective recognition of diversity as a priority for future success of our communities. Creative approaches help build a diverse workforce and foster a work environment where employees feel valued and appreciated. The most successful business leaders understand that incorporating diversity and inclusion into a company's values will significantly improve their company's ability to prosper and attract new talent. A diverse and inclusive workforce ignites stronger decision-making by welcoming a variety of perspectives at the table. It ensures a more accurate reflection of a company's customer base, allowing more opportunity for customers to connect with an organization and its employees. It also improves employee engagement, which is critical to a company's success. PNC's continued partnership with Triangle Business Journal is an investment in our local business community and its employees. Like each winner and nominee, PNC has an unwavering commitment to an inclusive culture and workforce. Again, thanks to the winners who are clearly leading the way in recognizing this important responsibility to build more inclusive and diverse companies. And that's from Jim Hansen, PNC Regional President, Eastern Carolinas. And we'll start with the Lifetime Achievement Award. That goes to Lori Jones Gibbs of PNC Bank. The headline, "This Banker is at Home When She is Helping People." And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Lori Jones Gibbs, Triangle Business Journal's Leaders in Diversity Lifetime Achievement Award winner, wouldn't describe herself as your typical banker. Growing up in public housing in Bridgeport, Connecticut, her initial goal was just to make lives better, not to make money. She saw her role in the community as a change agent, and the best way to elicit change, she thought at the time, was with young people. Out of college, she became a counselor. But she didn't initially realize the emotional toll it would take. The needs were significant. One day, she met with three siblings kicked out of their home by a mother who picked a lover over her own children. Another day, she dealt with a child who had been abused by a family member. "How do you tell these kids their parents love them?" she recalls asking herself. "It became really emotional for me. I didn't think I would do these young people a service. I would become too emotionally attached." So at 23, she took a day off work and visited three local banks, applying for their local management training programs. "At the time, you could just go to their human resources office and apply," she recalls. "Imagine that." Out of the two offers she received, she picked the People's Bank out of Connecticut, a name she was familiar with because of its community service. And months into her new career, she felt the spark. In banking, she could be the change agent she'd always envisioned. She could help her community by actually enabling its members to improve their situation, and the feeling of accomplishment when a client became a first-time home buyer became addictive. "I realized I was in the right career path when people walked up to me in public and said, 'Thank you,'" she recalls. While she was working in mortgage, two sisters came for advice about buying a house. It would become a eureka moment for Gibbs, solidifying that she had found her calling at last. "I said, 'You're going to have to do some work in order to qualify for this mortgage,'" she remembers. After 9 months, the sisters had elevated their credit score and successfully applied for their first mortgage. They were first-generation homeowners. The result of that is, once they become homeowners, other relatives realized they could do it. It was a multiplying effect. In another situation, a woman approached Gibbs in a department store with her daughter and told Gibbs, "It's because of you that she's in college." Gibbs says, "Home ownership can help you start a business, help you send your children to college." It's just one of dozens of experiences she has collected over the years. The key to her mission ended up being financial education, she says. If you give people information where they can make an informed decision, 9 out of 10 times they'll make the right decision, she explains. After relocating to North Carolina for her husband's job 5 years later, she took on multiple roles in banking. Her roles were at multiple institutions, BB&T, Mechanics and Farmers, Self-Help Credit Union, Genworth Financial, and PNC. Every job I pretty much had something to do with economic development or economic empowerment, empowering those who have been left out and not included, trying to improve their situation, she says, calling her job at PNC, an accumulation of all the experiences I've had. Gibbs, Senior Vice President of Community Development, Carolina's Market Manager for PNC, leads a team of people who focus on how PNC can partner with organizations to initiate or expand existing community and economic development opportunities. Gibbs says leaders should always consider their communities and be thankful for their blessings, and they need to work harder on the inclusion piece of diversity. At a time like this, we must realize love is in need of love, and we must embrace and be more inclusive of our differences, she says. How did you contribute to your organization's diversity mission? I serve as a member and liaison of the Eastern Carolina's Diversity and Inclusion Council. In this capacity, I work with the market's regional president and the company's corporate diversity and inclusion office to help generate revenue by attracting new customers, partnering with suppliers, and hiring employees who reflect the market we serve. What are some of the biggest accomplishments by you and/or your company in the past year in the field of diversity? Annually, our company holds an awards program to recognize the achievements of the champions who are driving diversity and inclusion initiatives across the organization. What are the greatest challenges or obstacles in implementing a diversity policy? From a policy perspective, diversity and inclusion efforts must be supported from the top of the organization by executives and senior leaders. We're fortunate to have a corporate diversity council that consists of senior leaders representing a wide range of business lines and chaired by our chairman, president, and CEO, William Demchak, and co-chaired by PNC's chief diversity officer, Marcia Jones. Where do you see the best example of diversity advancing in the triangle? I would have to say my adopted city, the city of Durham. What does the triangle need to do to have a vibrant atmosphere for a thriving, diverse workforce across all sectors? Diversity today means more than race and gender. There's growing significance placed on creating environments where a variety of different voices are encouraged and heard. These voices come from people who may or may not be of the same gender, race, or ethnicity. What is your most rewarding volunteer experience? Helping others embrace and obtain personal economic empowerment by understanding it's not what you earn for a living, but how you manage what you earn. I enjoy empowering people to understand the impact of homeownership on their ability to accumulate wealth, as well as giving them tools to allow them to be more financially responsible. What is your favorite thing about living in the Triangle? The continued growth of racially diverse communities and the array of food choices. And in a caption of information, name, Lori Jones Gibbs, company, PNC Bank, title, Senior Vice President, Community Development Banking, Carolinas Market, age, 61, company description, Diversified Financial Services Institution, birthplace, Bridgeport, Connecticut, family members, husband, Kenneth, daughters, Claudia and Tanisa, son, Kenneth Jr., grandchildren, Joshua, Avia, Caleb, and Avery. Education, BA in Urban Studies, University of Connecticut, MS in Management Administration, University of Bridgeport. And we'll read more of those profiles if time allows at the end. For now, we'll turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by Managing Editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, Wake Tech shows off RTP effort to close skills gap. Wake Technical Community College is booming, as a group of architectural students from NC State University saw on a recent trip to Research Triangle Park. The students toured Wake Tech's RTP campus in Morrisville on August 24 as part of their Architectural Construction Systems course. The first phase of the campus on Chapel Hill Road is a 109,000-square-foot building that will hold 28 classrooms and a lab and is scheduled to open in 2018. The new campus is a key move for Wake Tech as it looks to provide RTP employers with graduates with needed skills. The campus will be Wake Tech's sixth as the school continues to expand rapidly. Wake Tech is serving about 23,000 students this fall. The RTP campus is a response to the skills gap, Wake Tech President Stephen Scott tells Biz. Scott says the idea is to develop students who can meet the needs of employers in the market, especially when it comes to IT. That will be one of the focuses for Western Wake, Scott says, noting that those jobs pay well and are in demand. He also says the school sees a need for graduates with skills in data analytics and cybersecurity. Wake Tech is continuing to grow at a time when many community colleges are seeing declining enrollments. If we have something and people don't come, we stop offering it, he says. We go after the areas where the marketplace says we need people. Crowdfunding effort helps lawyers. Campbell Law School took a novel approach to helping students prepare for the bar, and it worked. A crowdfunding campaign provided stipends to 103 students sitting for the bar for things like rent and food while they focused on the exam. We were delighted to raise over $32,000, which allowed us to give all of our students who completed their bar preparation a stipend of $300 to offset their summer expenses, says Campbell Law Dean Rich Leonard. Their gratitude was overwhelming, as much for the show of support as for the funds, and we will evaluate other law school initiatives to see if this model will work again. One student, Kyle Frizzell, says he appreciated the boost. I'm sure I speak for many others when I say thank you and thanks Campbell Law for everything, Frizzell says. Leonard says he had found discretionary money the last two summers to give students a small stipend, but that money had been used up. About a year ago, I went to a dean's conference, and one of the workshops was about crowdfunding in an academic setting, he says. Since then, he says, I've been looking for a cause at the law school that would get general support to see if it would work. For practice, Air Force One makes a quick run to RDU. A very recognizable Boeing 747 could be seen coming in for a landing at Raleigh-Durham International Airport on August 28. Air Force One. President Donald Trump was not on board, however. RDU spokesman Andrew Sawyer says Air Force One, which made multiple passes over the airfield, was conducting training exercises. Technically, the jet is referred to as Air Force One when the president is on board. From our observations, it appeared as though they were practicing takeoffs and landings on our short 7,500-foot runway, Sawyer said in an email, noting that it's normal for Air Force One to occasionally do training drills at other airports. No special accommodations were made for the tests. Golf and tennis champs in the making in Wake County. If you see elementary school kids practicing golf or tennis around Wake County, it may be part of a growing effort to teach those sports to youth. Mary Ann Von Seegern spent 30 years in the corporate world before retiring and deciding to open her own business. She started a local TGA franchise for Teach, Grow, Achieve. Now her golf and tennis programs are at more than 40 Wake County schools. We basically teach them from the very beginning how to hold a club, how to stand. We teach them life lessons, she says, and we do the same for tennis as well. The idea is to teach drills that focus on muscle memory and build basic skills. Von Seegern says she has about 3,000 children in the program. I want to see how big we can get this, she says. Johnston County gets creative. Here at Biz, we always get enthusiastic about popcorn. So we thought, sweet, when the innovative Johnston County Economic Development Team sent a flash drive with a movie promoting the county and included popcorn as well. Director Chris Johnson says Johnston County sent out a VHS tape years ago to promote the county, and he thought it was time to update that idea. So Johnston County did a new video and figured, hey, why not include popcorn? The promotional packs went out to about 350 groups from site consultants in key markets across the United States to media outlets. It's just something to try and stand out and try to tell a story, Johnson says. Hopefully it's captivating enough to garner some attention and tell the story about the community and who we are. Cool idea, and just for the record, Biz absolutely, positively refuses to accept any bribes whatsoever. Popcorn is an exception. Sorry, Kitty Hawk, Triangle made flight history too. Here's a little bit of local aviation trivia. On a recent trip to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's Udvar Hazy Center near Washington Dulles International Airport, Biz discovered that the Triangle had a couple of celebrities on display. Two of the original gyrogliders and gyrocopters built by Raleigh engineer Igor Benson. Benson, a Russian immigrant, started the Benson Aircraft Company in Cary in 1953, peddling home-built aircraft kits. The kits started at $100 and were even sold through Montgomery Ward catalogs, the museum said. Benson's unpowered gyroglider relied on an automobile or other motorized vehicle to pull the aircraft along with a tether rope, and later included a line of powered gyrocopters that helped fuel the revival of the cheap form of recreational aviation. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, New Plans Percolating for Apex Tap Room. One of the original big promoters of local craft brewers, Carrboro-based Tyler's Tap Room, has announced it will be closing its Apex location September 6th, but then again, maybe not. Tyler's Tap Room owner, Tyler Huntington, says that shortly after announcing to his staff and customers that he would be closing his Apex restaurant, his phone started ringing. I've been approached by a couple of people who want to work with me to keep it open, Huntington said August 28th. So we're talking. It'll either close down on the 6th or it may not. It's all in flux right now. Huntington wouldn't identify the potential new business partners for the Apex restaurant, which has been open for about 10 years at the Beaver Creek Commons Shopping Center, but he says his decision to close had nothing to do with the location's traffic or sales performance. Sources estimate the 9,000-square-foot restaurant was generating more than $2 million in annual revenue. I've just got too much going on, and I haven't been able to give it the attention it needs, he said. Tyler's Tap Room also has restaurant and bar locations in Carrboro and Durham that have been open since 1998 and 2004, respectively. In addition to Tyler's Tap Room, Huntington is a managing partner at the Rick House event space on Foster Street in downtown Durham, a Durham catering company that he'd like to expand, and the new Two Doors Distilling Company that's expected to open in the winter with a line of liqueurs, rum, and whiskey. And in the spring, Huntington and his partners opened Maybell's Biscuits and Barbecue, a new breakfast and lunch restaurant near his taproom at the American Tobacco Campus in Durham. Apple Gold Group likely to close more locations of its Applebee's stores. The Apple Gold Group of Raleigh, the third largest franchisee in the Applebee's restaurant chain, has been quietly shutting down underperforming restaurants across its footprint in seven states over the past year. But its Raleigh executives won't say how many more of its restaurants will be affected by the parent company's plans to close up to 135 locations by the end of 2017. For all retail and casual dining restaurants specifically, it's been tough going these last couple of years, says BJ Stoltz, General Counsel and Vice President of Development at Apple Gold Group. At its peak in 2015, Apple Gold Group had about 133 restaurants and 6,800 employees company-wide in seven states, including about 600 employees in the Triangle. As of mid-August, however, Apple Gold Group had a total of 115 units in operation and a staff of about 4,200 employees. Reports, home builders beefing up inventory of new homes. The Triangle's home building market posted another quarter of big gains in new home closings, permits, and construction starts in the second quarter, even as contractors face a shortage of workers and rising land costs, two factors pushing average home pricing costs even higher. New home closings or final sales were up 4.6% in the second quarter compared to a year prior, and annualized sales were up 8%, according to a recently released report by Metro Study, a residential real estate research firm. North Carolina, according to Metro Study, is the fourth most active state for home building. The total inventory homes in the Triangle that were either under construction, finished vacant, or serving as a model home was up 11% in the second quarter, with 6,568 units in inventory. However, the region was still pretty close to what's considered the market's equilibrium of supply to demand, with a 7.3-month average supply of inventory available. Even if we have an economic downturn, it would not be as severe because of the level of inventory, says David Brown, Senior Vice President of Metro Study. Residential building permits, another important metric that helps track future builder activity, were up 13% year over year in the second quarter, with 3,618 permits issued, according to The Market Edge, a research firm that tracks only residential and commercial building permits in markets across the Southeast. Year-to-date building permits for residential are up 15%. Company buys Kroger-anchored Maynard Crossing. A retail affiliate of the publicly traded Preferred Campus Management Company in Atlanta has acquired its second major retail center in the Triangle, the Kroger-anchored Maynard Crossing Shopping Center, located at the corner of Northwest Maynard and High House Roads in Cary. Terms of the deal have not been disclosed, and a record of the deed transaction had not yet been posted in Wake County as of August 30, but the company confirmed it is financing the acquisition using an $18.5 million non-recourse loan from Principal Financial Group. PCM acquired the asset through its wholly owned subsidiary, New Market Properties, LLC, which also owns the Harris Teeter-anchored Heritage Station Shopping Center in Wake Forest. The seller at Maynard Crossing was a joint venture formed in late 2016 between Regency Centers Corporation and USAA Real Estate Company. Maynard Crossing was built in 1996 with 122,783 square feet of retail space. The center was 100% occupied as of the end of the second quarter, 2017, according to TBJ's Space Report. Representing the sellers in the transaction were Rob Carter, Rad von Wersowitz, Alex Carrier, and David Webb of Berkeley Capital Advisors in Charlotte. Cary Park Town Center sold for $25 million. The Harris Teeter-anchored Cary Park Town Center on Green Level Church Road has a new owner. According to Wake County deed records, InventTrust Properties of Delaware bought the shopping center for $25 million on August 14. The seller, Cary Park TC LLC, is a registered. The seller, Cary Park TC LLC, is registered with the Secretary of State's office to Brown Brothers Real Estate Trust 1 of New York. Cary Park Town Center sits on 12.33 acres and counts Dunkin' Donuts, Starbucks, and First Citizens Bank among its tenants. The shopping center was 100% leased as of the second quarter, according to Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space report. Ivan Trust also owns the Renaissance Center retail center near the streets at South Point Mall in Durham and the Point at Creedmoor Shopping Center in Raleigh. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onisorge. The first headline, MaxPoint being acquired, going private. 2 years after its public markets debut, Morrisville-based advertising technology firm MaxPoint Interactive plans to go private in a deal worth $95 million. The stealthy technology company is being acquired by Michigan-based Velasys Communications, and while its executives aren't commenting on how the deal will impact its 360-plus headcount, securities filings offer some details. According to the documents disclosed hours after the deal announcement, August 28, MaxPoint's board of directors approved lump-sum cash bonuses payable to certain employees when the transaction closes, which is expected in the fourth quarter. The only employee specifically named as receiving one of the bonuses is Chief Financial Officer Brad Schomber, who would be paid $75,000 if he's still with the firm at deal close. As for employees, certain stock options will be cashed out when the deal closes for an amount equal to the difference between the offer price of $13.86 per share and the option exercise price. Vested restricted stock units will cash out at amounts equal to the offer price. The unvested stock options and RSUs that would have vested by the end of the year will vest in full at closing. Stock grants are part of MaxPoint's compensation to employees. According to MaxPoint's March filed proxy, stock awards are granted to all new hires when their employment commences. Generally, the awards vest over 4 years, with 25% vesting after the completion of 12 months of service with the company. As of March 1, all outstanding stock options held by named executive officers were deemed underwater, meaning they have exercise prices that were greater than the stock's current market price. Stockholders representing 49.4% of the company's shares have already entered into support agreements, including CEO Joe Epperson. The company's board has approved the deal. MaxPoint shares closed at $13.70 the day of the deal announcement, up 148%. While it's above the $11.50 offering price from 2015, that doesn't take into account a reverse stock split the company went through in 2016. Executives and directors hold about 51.1% of the company as of the proxy filing in March. Largest owners of MaxPoint as of March: Trinity Ventures, 23.1%, Madrona Ventures, 19.1%, CEO Joe Epperson, 8.7%, COO Gretchen Joyce, 2.3%, Kevin Dulski, Director, 2.1%, and CFO Brad Schomber, 1%. Top Triangle Funder explains when to raise capital. Todd Olson, CEO of Raleigh-based software firm Pendo, says raising capital is all about acceleration, and he should know. Pendo's $25 million funder in July made it the largest new equity raise in the Triangle so far in 2017. Over the past 6 months, the Raleigh software firm has raised $45 million, according to securities filings. After reviewing the largest entrepreneurial fundraises of the year, TBJ asked Olson about the process, both making the decision to raise capital and executing the deal. Why should an entrepreneur consider an equity raise? The decision to raise capital really comes down to an entrepreneur understanding what kind of company they want to create and what kind of market you're in. When we started our company, we looked at the market. We saw that there were some existing vendors out there that maybe didn't have the exact same vision as us, but could be competitive. We realized speed was necessary to seize the overall opportunity. If speed is important, raising capital is the way to accelerate the business. Think about what raising capital enables you to do: spend money, invest in the business, and generate growth. If we didn't raise money, we'd probably still grow, just a lot slower. What's the biggest misconception entrepreneurs have about raising capital? One of the things that too many entrepreneurs get ultra-focused on is dilution and valuation. I've talked to so many entrepreneurs who say, "I don't want to raise money because I don't want to give up blah, blah percentage of the company." I'd say it's just a very short-term thought process. I'm always thinking about, what kind of company are we trying to create? What's the ultimate business we're trying to build? I'm less focused on giving up blah, blah percent. What we gave up is maybe small in contrast to what we're capable of building. Cree founder sees opportunity. "Whatever we can build, we've got customers for it," says Cree co-founder John Palmore. Palmore, who leads Cree's power and radio frequency unit, Wolfspeed, spoke after the company's 30th anniversary celebration. Palmore's laboratory focuses on powering technology more efficiently. Palmore says Cree is adding more lines to its Wolfspeed manufacturing operations. The growth, he notes, is driven by electric vehicles. "It's really great to be a part of something like this." Triangle getting interest from rising tech companies. Foursquare chairman Dennis Crowley recently confirmed the New York City-based social media firm has the Raleigh area on its short list for a new engineering office. Adam Klein, Chief Strategy Officer of American Underground, says growth companies in big markets are often looking here. These larger companies love the quality and diversity of technical talent in the market and can tap into it for a fraction of the cost in the larger metros, Klein says. Plus, they are less concerned about a top-notch developer here leaving their firm in 6 months to pursue another opportunity in the market. And under a section called Raising Funds, entrepreneurs have record-setting first half of 2017. In the first half of 2017, entrepreneurs in North Carolina raised a record-setting $768.9 million in equity capital, and 93 companies participated in 107 deals. Of those, 48 were technology companies, completing 50 deals in the first half of the year. That's according to the recently released Innovators Report out of the Council for Entrepreneurial Development in Durham. The numbers are $595.5 million in technology, $139.7 million in life sciences, $23.2 million in clean tech, and $10.6 million in advanced materials. Turning to Jennifer Henderson's page on life sciences, the first headline, Mission Health, WellCare Reach a Deal. Amid plans to cancel its contracts with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, effective October 5, Mission Health has inked a new agreement with WellCare of North Carolina. The company is a provider of Medicaid and Medicare services and is a subsidiary of WellCare Health Plans based in Tampa, Florida. Mission Health's agreement with WellCare, which serves roughly 33,000 Medicare prescription drug plan members in North Carolina, comes at a time when Mission Health and BCBSNC have remained at odds over payment rates. As a hospital system, Mission Health serves 18 counties in western North Carolina. In July, Mission Health cited the pending shift to insurance company-run Medicaid in North Carolina and Affordable Care Act repeal and replace discussions as reasons it was reevaluating its relationship with BCBSNC. Mission Health spokeswoman Rona Buffett Tim said in an email, "The new WellCare agreement, in addition to our recent announcements of brand new agreements with Cigna and Aetna, demonstrate Mission Health's reasonableness in working with insurers. These actions are part of our comprehensive strategy to facilitate a dramatically more competitive insurance market in western North Carolina." Earlier this month, Mission Health approached BCBSNC with a proposal to partially rescind termination of its contracts and accept BCBSNC's payment rates for Affordable Care Act members. But that proposal was rejected by the insurer, with BCBSNC President and CEO Brad Wilson stating that Mission Health continues to turn its back on senior citizens, state and county employees, businesses and taxpayers across western North Carolina. Since then, Mission Health has outlined advanced planning steps for patients ahead of the impending cancellation of contracts with BCBSNC. According to Mission Health, BCBSNC Medicare Supplemental Plans or Medigap Health Plans are not impacted. MedPharm expects to add staff in RTP this year. UK-based pharmaceutical development and manufacturing company MedPharm is continuing to grow its first U.S. location in Research Triangle Park, which opened last year. Before then, privately held MedPharm, which specializes in dermatology, had operated out of the UK for two decades, but now beefing up its RTP location stateside is a top priority. MedPharm is looking to grow its business substantially over the next couple of years, says John Len, head of MedPharm's U.S. operations. Len joined the company in 2015 from Stifel, a GlaxoSmithKline company. As of December, MedPharm had 7 employees based at its new RTP location. The company now employs 16 people locally and expects to add a few more by the end of 2017, Len says. One of MedPharm's recent hires locally is Jeremy Drummond, Vice President of Business Development, who has about two decades of experience in leadership positions related to commercial supply of pharmaceutical companies. MedPharm also tapped Simon Redgrove, founder and former managing partner of the UK's Cavanaugh Group as chairman of its board. Avadim raises $7.3 million as Avadim, that's spelled A-V-A-D-I-M, continues its 550 job expansion in North Carolina. The Asheville-based life sciences company has raised about $7.3 million of a planned $20 million equity offering, according to a company filing with the SEC. The filing lists the date of first sale as March 15. Avadim CEO Steve Woody has said the company, founded in 2007, had raised $40 million to date. Its largest investors, he said, are healthcare officials with high net worths. The financing disclosure comes shortly after Avadim launched one of its products, TheraWorks Relief, in Rite Aid and other pharmacies nationwide. Woody said it was the first nationwide pharmacy launch for the company. In an announcement, Avadim stated that the U.S. market for TheraWorks Relief, a foam or spray for the treatment of muscle spasms and cramps, is 29 million people. Kerry Company accuses competitor of stealing secrets. Kerry-based Redox Tech, which specializes in soil and groundwater remediation, has filed a trade secrets lawsuit against a competitor in Georgia and its founder. Redox Tech alleges that a member of the company, who is also a member of Redox Tech's parent company, Redox Properties, took valuable trade secrets last month to start a company called Earthworks Solutions. The complaint was moved this week to federal court. According to the complaint, the defendant formed a scheme earlier this year to start a company to solicit and steal business and clients from Redox by using confidential and trade secret information. Those trade secrets included pricing, profit margins, and production rates, as well as engineering specifications and customer and supplier lists, Redox claimed. Founded in 1995, Redox says it currently employs upward of 30 people. President John Hassalo declined to comment August 29 on the pending litigation. Redox in the complaint stated, defendants' actions in furtherance of the scheme are causing immediate and irreparable harm to plaintiff, including but not limited to driving down plaintiff's prices, taking client and or potential clients of whom defendant became aware while working with plaintiff, and damaging plaintiff's reputation. And finally on this page, Thermo Fisher completes Patheon acquisition. Durham-based contract development and manufacturing organization Patheon is now officially part of Massachusetts-based Thermo Fisher. The companies announced August 29 that Thermo Fisher had completed its acquisition of Patheon for $7.2 billion, including debt. The closing comes at a time when CDMOs and contract research organizations have used mergers and acquisitions to beef up capabilities and gain market share. Patheon reported revenue of roughly $1.9 billion last year. Thermo Fisher continues to expect to realize total synergies of approximately $120 million by year three following the close, consisting of approximately $90 million of cost synergies and approximately $30 million of adjusted operating income benefit, the company stated. Patheon, led by CEO James Mullen, employs 1,700 people in North Carolina. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to a couple of stories from around the state. First, Lidl to debut in Charlotte region as four stores open. This article is written by Jennifer Thomas. German grocer Lidl will open its first stores in the Charlotte market this month. Two stores at 9990 Charlotte Highway in Indian Land and 1005 East Dixon Boulevard in Shelby will open on September 21. On September 28, the location at 951 East Hudson Boulevard in Gastonia will open, as will another in Rock Hill's Riverwalk development at 1260 Herons Ferry Road. Those are the first locations for Lidl in the Charlotte market. The grocer has expressed its interest in the market, but until August 30, declined to confirm locations or opening timetables. Lidl's name has also been tied to several locations in the region, including in South End, one at Orchard Lake Drive, and Monroe Road in Charlotte, as well as others in the University area, Concord, and Mooresville, those stores are part of Little's plans for North America. It set an initial goal of opening 20 stores in the Carolinas and Virginia this summer, but surpassed those. It anticipates having 100 stores on the East Coast by next summer. By comparison, Little has more than 10,000 stores in Europe in 28 countries. Little has created a model for its North American stores that includes floor-to-ceiling windows that flood the store with light. It incorporates wood, brick, and polished concrete floors. Stores feature about 20,000 square feet of selling space, though have just 6 wide aisles to shop. Luxury apartments to rise in Winston-Salem. The West End in downtown Winston-Salem will be home to a new luxury apartment community. West End Station, a 229-unit building with modern amenities, including enclosed parking, saltwater swimming pool, fitness center, elevated and landscaped courtyards, is scheduled to open in about 2 years, according to developers DPJ Residential and Chaucer Creek Capital. Porter Jones, principal of DPJ, estimated the project cost at $35 million. He said he expected the units to open in about 2 years. The address is 206 North Green Street. DPJ and Chaucer Creek, through their West End Station LLC, paid $2.534 million for the 4.31 acres, closing on April 3. A lot of the products in Winston-Salem now are cool, Porter said, but they do lack the modern features and amenities many people are looking for. It's our goal to offer residents a different and more modern living experience than the majority of the communities downtown. Jones said the apartments would be within walkable distances to restaurants, parks, bars, and entertainment venues. Walkability is our number one criteria for site selection, something this property exemplifies to a T, Jones said. We believe this is a prime location given its close proximity to Winston's largest employers, retailers, and entertainment venues. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, and we start with the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "It's the aftermath that needs our attention." I have quite a bit of family in Houston, and I worked in the Houston-Beaumont area for a few years covering the petrochemical industry. While all of us watched Hurricane Harvey unleash its water-filled wrath on Texas, I could not stop thinking about the after-effects of this storm on the country's fourth-largest city and its neighboring areas. Harvey was a rain event. Because most of the properties in the Houston area are not on a flood zone, most of the flood damage to homes and properties are not covered by flood insurance, as very few bought the insurance. The Federal Emergency Management Agency runs the National Flood Insurance Program, NFIP. But here are the dire facts. Hundreds of thousands of home and property owners have to mostly pay from their own pockets to fix their belongings. Initial estimates suggest less than 2 out of 10 affected residents in the Houston area have flood insurance. To put that in context, during Katrina, 5 out of 10 residents around the New Orleans area had flood insurance. The Houston Metro houses some 6 million plus people. The New Orleans Metro clocks in about 1.2 million people. We're talking about an affected area that is 5 times bigger. Beyond what Congress does next week to help the victims, it is likely hundreds of thousands of people will need much more to repair their homes and get new transportation. The American Community Survey's most recent report shows per capita income in Houston was $31,668 in 2015. It doesn't take a genius to figure out the math and the liability staring at these people. The current NFIP model simply does not work. The plan owes the federal government $24 billion for all the loans it took out to help people with insurance. In fact, the NFIP has yet to pay back all the loans it took out after Hurricane Katrina ravaged Louisiana in 2005. So why does the math not work? That's primarily because flood insurance is a heavily subsidized program, and homeowners who paid about 1% of the total premiums have used some 20 to 30% of total insurance payout. Many of them were repeat claimers. The average cost of flood insurance policy is $700 per year. lower for low-risk areas, and a little higher for homes in high-risk zones. The NFIP covers up to $250,000 for the structure of the home and $100,000 for personal property. For now, however, rebuilding the lives of people in Texas is up to all of us, not only the federal government. Millions of volunteers, along with private industry, answered Louisiana's call some 12 years ago. We need to double down on that sentiment for this tragedy. And in the People on the Move section, the spotlight is on Kevin O'Brien, Vice President of Neurosciences MERS North America. Life Sciences veteran Kevin O'Brien was named Vice President of Neurosciences at specialty healthcare company MERS North America. O'Brien, who has served in various executive-level roles at Allergan and Johnson & Johnson, is now charged with developing the leading strategy for MERS's NA sales, marketing, and managed markets teams from its Raleigh HQ. MERS NA moved ops to the Triangle in early 2015, where 250 of its 860-plus employees are now located. MERS is based in Frankfurt, Germany, and has a total of more than 2,700 employees. Bob Radigan, also a former Allergan exec, was named CEO of MERS NA in April. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? Many people look at my role and think it is all about strategy and the numbers, but to me it focuses on the people, both our internal colleagues and most importantly, our customers. What's a goal you have in this new position? Our vision at MERS is to be the most admired, trusted, and innovative aesthetics and neurology company. Biggest worry? That I won't find a house in this hot Raleigh housing market. And now we turn to an article section called New in Town that focuses on Ashley Backert. The headline, Boosting Sports in the Bull City. This Q&A column was written by Cameron Snipes. The Durham Sports Commission was established in August 2016. Its mission is to create economic and social impact by leading the community's efforts to attract, support, and promote youth, amateur, collegiate, and professional sporting and recreational events. Fast forward just a few months to early 2017, and the commission now has an executive director, Ashley Backert. And though she is a Durham native, she's new to the Triangle's professional scene. In this role, Backert is charged with leading the efforts of the 501c3 organization. The DSC is a collaboration of the City of Durham, Durham County, the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, and the Durham Convention and Visitors Bureau, and is governed by a 9-member board of directors. Triangle Business Journal caught up with Backert to learn her goals for the commission and what she believes to be the Bull City's greatest sporting strengths and what it still lacks in that regard. What drew you to this position? The chance to showcase my hometown to the sports world was an attention grabber, while the opportunity to build the organization from the ground up was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. I grew up in Durham and attended Northern Durham High School before going on to play softball at the University of Connecticut, so I know firsthand how sports can positively impact lives. There's so much sports history in Durham, and it is fun to be in a position where I can highlight that, while also making sure sports continue to be a pillar of our community as the area grows so quickly. Durham's made a splash on the national level for its food, arts, and tech scenes. I am passionate about making sure Durham is known for sports as well. What are your specific duties in your current role? Since August 2016, when the DSC was first created, our board has been working hard to put together all the building blocks needed for our nonprofit to be successful. With DSC's foundation and vision now set, I have three main focuses moving forward: to support locally owned and operated events, recruit owners and associations to bring their sports events to Durham, and build community recognition for the DSC. Sports tourism is a $7.68 billion industry, and I ultimately work to make sure the DSC acts as an agent of economic development for the area. More sports events means more business for Durham. What are your short and long-term goals for the Durham Sports Commission? An immediate goal is to make sure those local event owners who have worked hard to advance sports in Durham over the years are taken care of and supported. Another short-term goal is to get on the radar and become part of the conversation for out-of-market event owners as quickly as possible. We hope to have multiple major sports events in Durham each year as a long-term goal. Bid cycles to host tournaments or championships are on 3 or 5 year timelines, so we're looking at securing events now for 2019 and beyond. I'm also looking to grow the types of facilities we have in the market. What do you need to achieve those goals? Community buy-in. In supporting local teams, coming out to enjoy sports events, and welcoming teams or new sports to the area, the community can make a huge difference in helping us attract more and bigger events. What experiences throughout your career have most prepared you for this role? My professional experience has prepared me well and runs the gamut, having held positions across both the sports and travel industries. I've been a facility manager, where I learned to generate leads and maintain a commercial recreation property. I was also a hotel sales manager, negotiating rates, overseeing renovations, and creating growth plans. What is the Bull City's biggest strength when it comes to attracting and promoting sporting events? Conversely, what does it lack? How easy it is for teams, families, and fans to travel to Durham is a huge asset, helping us attract more national or regional events. Durham is booming and has so many hotel, food, and entertainment options for us to lure out-of-town teams, fans, and families looking for things to do on an off or rainy day. Durham's places to play are also a strength. We have everything from youth sports facilities, golf courses, and a 10,000-seat baseball stadium to a curling center, pickleball courts, and disc golf courses. Facilities here are affordable, accessible, and available, all of which are key strengths in attracting new sporting events. We will be launching a facility study soon to find out more about what exactly we lack, as well as what the DSC can help provide to create more premier sports experiences. What does the ideal Durham sports scene look like? An ideal sports scene welcomes and attracts as many people to the 2018 ACC Baseball Championship Fan Fest as other great festivals or entertainment acts in Durham. We're already planning to make sure Fan Fest is special, appealing to the intense fans, keeping pitch counts in the stands, and counting and scouting baseball's next big stars, and those who just might want to enjoy the family-friendly and social things that come along with catching a game at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. The ideal Durham sports scene is also diverse. The sports scene will be reflective of who we are as a community, and that means not being cookie cutter and working with new and emerging sports. And in a box, along with this article titled Closer Look, age 34, title organization, executive director, Durham Sports Commission, education, BS in sports marketing, University of Connecticut, Master's degree in Sports Administration, University of Southern Mississippi. Certificate in Nonprofit Management, Duke University. Family, husband Aaron, daughter Michaela. First job, working for my mom. She owns her own dog grooming shop in Durham, and I was hired to bathe dogs starting in middle school. And now we turn to the small business section, where we read Jim Verdonick's column. Jim Verdonick is an attorney with Warden Smith, PA in Raleigh, and author of Crowdfunding, A Legal Guide to Investment and Platform Regulation. The headline on this column, Why Companies Need to Have a Blockchain Strategy. We've all seen the cartoons about a person holding a sign, Repent, the end of the world is coming. It would be nice if earth-shaking events were always preceded by clear signs, wouldn't it? Actually, the history of signs is that most people ignore them. After economic bubbles burst, the pundits all point out the signs most people ignored. Most signs are clear only in hindsight. Even clear signs tell you what will happen, but not when. So, here are some warning signs you will probably ignore. In July, the SEC declared that many blockchain-based artificial currencies may be securities. On August 1, Delaware changed its corporate law to permit corporations to use blockchain technology to keep stockholder records. These are warning signs, because most people think of blockchain as the basis for shady cryptocurrencies. Drugs, terrorism, and tax evasion come to mind. but blockchain is becoming an important finance and business tool that extends far beyond its original uses. That's the reason two of the most important corporate and securities organizations decided it's time to address blockchain technology. The SEC knows that leaving blockchain financial instruments unregulated would create huge holes in its securities and capital-raising regulatory structure. The Delaware legislature realizes that stock certificates and traditional stock ledgers remain the most inefficient part of the system that keeps track of ownership interests and wants to keep Delaware's lucrative business of being home to most major corporations. In effect, both institutions have put the world on notice that they don't intend to let a new disruptive technology make them irrelevant. To avoid irrelevancy, they decided they need a blockchain strategy. That raises a question. Does your business need a blockchain strategy to avoid becoming irrelevant? Before you answer no, remember that much of the brick-and-mortar world relished the dot-com stock market crash that occurred at the turn of the 20th century. Hundreds of dot-com companies crashed, fortunes disappeared. By 2002, it seemed the brick-and-mortar world was safe from the dot-com barbarians. 15 years later, the brick-and-mortar world's relief over the dot-com bust was premature. Probably initially, or will we see something similar with blockchain technology? Probably. Initially, we will see a boom and bust cycle. Overenthusiastic investors often create bubbles. But bubbles only kill investors. Bubbles don't destroy disruptive technology. And blockchain technology has many disruptive capabilities, including transparency, replacing paper with digital information, cost reduction, and eliminating human error. And we'll stop right there as we run out of time for this episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.